Today's program was brought to you by Fiji Water and Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
Hey, Food Radio listeners. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie, and I'm really excited to share that we're launching a brand new show. Meat and Three is HRN's weekly food news roundup. Tune in for a deep dive and three tasty shorts every Friday evening. It's 15 minutes, so you can listen while you wait for your pizza. This week, the fight for universal free lunch in New York City public schools isn't over yet.
I'm overburdened. I'm overworked. I don't get staff when people are out.
Plus, Dana Cowan, former editor of Food & Wine magazine and host of HRN's Speaking Broadly, catches up with Valerie Lomas, the winner of the Great American Baking Show's Derailed Season 3. Discover how a Danish brewery is motivating people to get fit, and hear Allison Roman speak to the highs and lows of her cookie recipe going viral.
Every time I see anyone in a social setting, that's generally the first thing they ask me is, how are the cookies?
Be better informed and wildly inspired by the stories and people you hear on Meat and Three. Find us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio Network. I can't believe it, but we're back live, and this is episode 57. Yes, 57. I'm your host, Eli Sussman, chef, co-owner of Samisa Restaurant, located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. If you're listening for the very first time, each week I welcome a chef or a restaurateur to basically share their life story in food, from their childhood to their earliest jobs in food, what their current job is, and where their future may take them. Today's guest is Chef Christina Leckie. Christina attended culinary school at the Art Institute of Philadelphia. She has worked for Alfred Portal, April Bloomfield, and she now leads the kitchen at an Andrew Tarlow restaurant, Reynard's, inside the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg. Christina, welcome to The Line.
Hi.
Let's start at the way beginning. You grew up in Philadelphia. Did you have a healthy house or a junk food house? And what was your early childhood food interactions like in your own childhood home?
I grew up in a definitely busy working class household, and Sundays were the day to have an actual sit down, healthy, or at least very homemade meal. And I very much looked forward to that. And I think very early on, I was very highly critical of my mom's cooking and would sometimes definitely throw mini temper tantrums if I did not approve of what she had chosen for her.
Because she made a lot of tuna casserole or something like that?
Not Midwestern-y, but like maybe a meatloaf every now and again. Any ground meat when I was a child was a cause of a sudden burst of anger.
Because of like the taste or just like a huge chunk of meat in a loaf is gross to little kids?
Yeah, exactly. I think the aesthetic of it really brought me down. But I was, you know, pretty savvy and kind of a survivalist, and spent a lot of time with my Italian grandparents from Italy, and would try to be at their house as often as possible because they were always cooking from the, you know, from scratch and from the heart.
Yeah, tell me about your grandparents. They had a garden in their backyard. They lived outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah, they had a nice, very small chunk of land, but a little bit of land in the suburbs, like 45 minutes to an hour outside of Philadelphia. And I would sort of escape there every chance I had more than like 2 days off. Easter break, definitely all summer, over Christmas. I would definitely just sort of gravitate towards there, and I just had a lot of fun with them. They were, you know, they loved me. They took care of me, you know. I was definitely like the apple of their eye in a lot of ways. And I feel like I just love to absorb sort of their culture and watch them cook and watch how they interacted with each other. And it was just really impressive. And they were just kind of old world. And I just sort of gravitated towards that.
Was there a Sunday gravy situation
there
with
them?
There
was definitely a Sunday. Like Sunday was, we would eat by like 3 p.m. and there would be multiple courses, usually like some sort of meat in the middle and then pasta at the end and then a big salad. some random jug wine that maybe my great uncle in New Jersey makes in his basement. It was always a little unclear where it came from. But definitely never saw a wine label in my house, in their house at all. It came from a secret cabinet in the basement.
Not a $9 jug of Rossi.
Yeah, and maybe it was. But they were definitely hiding that. they love to take their time cooking, and when my great grandmother was alive, she would like set up the table every Sunday and make, you know, some sort of handmade pasta, and that sort of kind of passed on when she passed on, but they definitely still took a lot of pride in the cooking that they did. I mean, my grandfather worked really hard for most of his life. He was a machinist. He worked in a factory, but he always joked and said my grandmother was kind of a bad cook. So he would come home after working like 12 hours a day and make dinner, and a pretty elaborate dinner. And we would wait, and it would be amazing. And even in the morning before he left for work, when I was staying with them in the summer, he would cook breakfast for me every morning. And it was like pretty, like it was just really great. And I felt really loved and taken care of.
What do you feel Philadelphia, going to school there, growing up there, how did it shape you? How did it shape you to be in the city, but also have that ability to kind of have that escape to the suburbs, that duality of growing up in sort of two different realms?
Yeah,
a little
totally.
Bit.
I mean, I don't know. I love Philly. It's kind of like, you know, you're from kind of a similar place or around similar kind of cities. It's just really real, and people are just sort of really straightforward and honest, and definitely tell you how they feel when they feel it. And you know, it's definitely like in a lot of ways for me, it just felt like a real like working class city that like was pretty liberal still too. And I don't know, I just felt like I had gotten such, I'm glad I grew up in such a diverse sort of community of people. And having that escape to go to the suburbs, which did feel very white and very kind of protected in a way. I liked that because I just liked being around my grandparents. I just thought they were cool. And I liked being, you know, and as I got older, I valued more being in the city, and I certainly started going to the suburbs less. And I don't know. I feel really grateful to grow up in the city for sure, as opposed to anywhere else.
You made the decision to stay there for school. And I know that there was a Japan trip somewhere. I don't know, was that pre-college or in the middle?
Yeah, that was my senior year of high school. I like begged my entire family to help me raise money to go on this trip. I'd honestly never been on a plane before. And I just was, you know, I feel like maybe in a lot of ways sometimes I can be a real extremist, like all or nothing. And for me, it was just like, oh my God, there's this one opportunity to go somewhere that like I'll never get to. I have to do this. And for me, I had never eaten Japanese food growing up. We just didn't eat that way. And that stuff wasn't like readily available. I think, you know, there weren't that many Japanese restaurants around. And so going there is what taught me about having a palate and watching my palate during that time grow. I mean, I feel like I was with a bunch of cranky high school kids, and I was like super immersed into the culture and into eating, whereas they were like, I miss home. I want to go back. I don't like this food. The texture's weird. The blah, you know, raw fish, ooh. Like, and I was like, raw fish, ooh, it's weird, but I kind of like it. Like, I remember like drinking green tea and just being like, I don't get what this green tea is all about. It tastes like hot water. And then by the end of the trip, I like could completely taste the subtleties of it and understood why it was like so revered, or why it was such a why it was such a precious thing, and how it was savored in a really sort of ceremonial way in a lot of ways. Because every night after our meal, the entire family that I was staying with would sit down, and it was multiple generations. I think that's quite common in Japan, where you definitely live with your grandparents, or the grandparents move in with you at a certain point because you're meant to take care of your elders. And so it was a huge extended family all living there. And yeah, we would have these like really like serene tea moments. And at first I was like, I don't get it. By the end of it, I was like, this is really awesome. Like, oh my God. And then by the end of it, I completely Americanized it. And we were like having green tea drinking contests and like, you know, watching like these like 90-year-old Japanese like grandma and grandpa like chugging something they probably have not done since. But
probably not. The subtleties that you touched on about Japanese food actually makes it a difficult food for a young person to kind of wrap their head around, because it's not French, which is big,
totally
fatty. It's not Italian, which, you know, there's big, bright sauces. A lot of Japanese food is like a dab, a drop of this sauce on
sure.
this small piece of fish. So what was the program, first off? And also, you said that, you know, you really immediately attached yourself to the cuisine and everything. Why do you think that was? Because you then went to do fashion, but clearly you'd been grabbed by
yeah.
food on
yeah,
this
was,
trip.
It stayed so. In the back of my mind. I mean, I almost contemplated going to culinary school after that, but I was like, I'm not ready. That seems like a lot of work. I was really still conflicted about what I wanted my life to look like at a young age. And, you know, I mean, I was there because, you know, I went to a public school in the city, and there was a teacher who was at my school who wanted to just mix, like Japanese people would come to my school for a couple months and then vice versa. But they students from our school had never gone there, and he really wanted to sort of get these city kids to see a completely different side of the world and a different culture. So that's why I was there. And we wouldn't go to classes per se, but we were taught calligraphy and we like got to sit in classes and sort of observe. But so it wasn't like formal educational. It was just more about submersing yourself in the culture and living with a family for an extended amount of time just to really get the idea of it. I don't know. I think it's like probably why I cook now, you know. I think it's like how shit is meant to be, you know, like I was there and I had a eureka moment. I like really, it changed my life. I was a different person after that trip. And I like had so much more love and appreciation of food. I had my first fine dining French experience while I was there, eating at like a really like stoic, amazing, crazy French place in Japan. Like in addition to eating all this incredible Japanese food. And it stuck with me. And I, like I said, I really felt like I understood what a palate was and it changed me.
When you come back, you are pursuing a fashion career. In what capacity were you in that realm? Were you doing design work? Were you hoping to be more on the buying side or the business side?
I definitely took a lot of business classes, and then I did some basic design classes. Learned a bit. I just like dabbled in all, like did a bit of textile design, definitely took a bunch of studio classes. I think for me, what I was learning was that I really just didn't want to be sitting at a desk in any capacity. So I kept trying to reimmerse myself in college, like in ways that would keep me active and like busy doing something like physically, not just typing on a computer. I was learning very quickly that like the thought of like office life in any form was just not going to be for me. I'd externed at some places and I did some personal, I was like a personal shopper for a couple people for a while. And I sort of like enjoyed that, but nothing was really sticking. And, you know, I was very nervous about having a happy, successful career. And I was kind of lazy. I didn't want to grind it out. I think in that industry, I was like, I was just confused about what kind of job I would end up with and was nervous about paying my dues, I think.
So you decided to grind it out in the culinary world, the easiest transition you could have made. So you go
it
to,
is sort of immediate gratification in a way.
You go to culinary school. Is it fair to draw some to make some correlations between like the tactile act of touching fabric and drawing and also
totally.
Putting plates together? Is it like the same part of your brain or is that not fair?
I think it's similar parts of your brain, you know? It is funny. Like you are definitely grinding it out and you have to earn your stripes in the cooking world, but it is kind of immediate gratification. You know, you can immediately get your hands on a vegetable and a knife and and start doing something, whether you're doing it well or not. You'll definitely be immediately told that. But I found it to be instantly gratifying and at least forward moving in a way that I think, like, paying my dues in the fashion industry was just not, it was going to be a lot more drudgery, I think.
You end up at Striped Bass.
Yep.
In Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your first job out of culinary school?
I was working in a couple, like I had a neighbor who had a couple restaurants in an area of Philadelphia called Chestnut Hill. And I was working in some of those restaurants in a pretty like lower kind of way and expediting and sort of doing some garmage and just sort of getting my feet wet. But when I actually didn't graduate culinary school, I sort of didn't like it. Felt like it was like I'd gone to college. I was, now I'm going to culinary school, but then I'm in a kitchen when I'm not in culinary school. And I felt like I was just learning more. And I think a lot of people think and say this, even though a lot of them probably graduate, but it just felt like it made more sense to just be doing it. So once I made the decision not to go back to school, I wanted to work in the most hardest place that was accessible for me, because I felt like I owe it to I need to learn now. Like, it's on my own. It's like up to me to get the education since I've decided not to like go through the schooling fully. And I felt like that's what Striped Bass was for me. It was like my culinary school.
And when you started there, you started as a line cook, a prep cook, something?
A line cook. And it was funny. My first day, I ran into a really close friend of mine in the hallway. I was like nervous as hell, definitely in over my head. Can't believe I got the job. And I ran into a friend from high school who is a friend of mine still and is cooking as well still. And it was great. I felt immediately sort of like at ease, like, okay, oh, you're doing this too. Awesome. Like, we got this. And I was definitely not a natural. Like, people were definitely surpassing me on stations, and I struggled a lot. But I feel like once I sort of got the hang of it, it was like no going back. Like, I was able to really like please my chefs and make myself known that I was like reliable and hardworking and consistent.
A lot of great chefs have come out of the Alfred Portal kitchens, just to name a few. Wiley Dufresne, Tom Colicchio, Bill Telepan are a couple of the New York guys that have been able to go on and do some pretty large scale projects. Is Chef Portal, is it a teaching kitchen or is it a forged by fire kitchen? And or is it both? And why was it such a valuable experience?
I think it was
there?
A teaching kitchen because, you know, I was working there 5 days a week, and then I would take a bus to New York and go to Gotham on my day off to see how the real place is run. And having that experience, I was like, holy shit, okay, like, I'm in New York. These people are doing like 300 covers. This thing is running like a seamless machine. Like, it was so impressive watching that kitchen work. And how many years it had worked. And I mean, shit, how many years it's still working. It's pretty insane. And yeah, I think it was pretty nurturing. I mean, it was definitely like, you know, you got your ass handed to you. But at the same time, they were building you up and teaching you the right things. I mean, I had no background to be anybody else except exactly what they wanted me to be. And luckily, I was in really good hands and they took really good care of me. I mean, I rose through the ranks there. Like, I left as a lead line cook. The chef de cuisine who was there had an opportunity to go to New York. He invited me. There was like sous chefs that didn't get asked to go. And I was like, sure, I'll go to New York. Like, why not? I never thought I'd ever want to live there, but I'll take the chance. And it was very, very rewarding for me.
So where did you go when you came to New York with the, it was the CDC that left Striped Bass?
Yeah. His name was Christopher Lee. His name is Christopher Lee. And we relaunched Gilt after Paul LeBrant.
And while at Gilt, it had great success, right? Like, mm-hmm. It obtained 2 Michelin stars, I believe, in its second year open, or
yeah,
its first year open?
I think in its first year.
In its first year.
Yeah.
And so your role there became, you transitioned to become a sous chef at
eventually,
at
yeah,
Gilt,
like
right?
after probably a year. And it was, again, a really rewarding experience. It was very fine dining. It was tasting menu only. You got to work with, you know, it was almost like a kitchen where money was no option. We could work with any ingredient and every ingredient. I got so exposed to so many different flavor profiles and just world, you know, like langoustines from flown all over from Scotland, like just ingredients from everywhere. And I mean, that really like was like, whoa, okay. Like it was a really, really rewarding experience. And I was really honored to like leave there having been a sous chef at like only been cooking for such a small amount of time.
There's kind of two tracks when you're rising up in a kitchen. One is just the fundamentals. Okay, is my technique good? Is my station set up? Am I doing my A job well? But your kind of other B job is, am I also learning leadership skills? Am I going to be able to become a sous chef? You were able to become a sous chef. How did it feel when you got there? And did you feel like you had a great grasp of what that role was at Gilt, or did you kind of feel?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was definitely in a lot of ways like a man's world there. And mm-hmm. I definitely struggled. I would feel, you know, when it's, you know, I always said when you work in fine dining, it's kind of like high end fashion. There's a lot of pretension. There's a lot of ego. There's a lot of self-righteousness. Just because you're, you know, you think because you're cooking food at such a high level that you're better than everyone else who's not doing that kind of cooking. And I'm sure the times have changed, but I do feel like it was really hard for me. I wasn't often very respected. And I mean, luckily I was friends with all the people who were my other peers and sous chefs, but the kitchen staff was tough. You know, I definitely got, I remember being called like a terrible name and like going up to my chef and being like, how can you allow this person to speak to me like this? And it just like, it got completely like brushed under the table and was like, well, just deal with it. But it's like, I'm a chef. I thought I was like a manager, you know, like how can you let like a line cook talk to me that way? And mm-hmm. it was definitely like some growing pains for sure. And I definitely learned a lot.
And being in that role where you're in this, for lack of a better term, like this old school style kitchen yeah. where everyone's yelling and all these things are happening where you're having to do your job, but there's internal and external forces
sure.
on you. How do you deal with that like outside of the restaurant? Like as you're kind of coming up in the culinary scene in New York City, are you feeling like beaten down, or do you internalize that to grow stronger, to say like, I'm going to toughen myself up against this?
Yeah.
Like what's the,
I mean, I was
thought process.
I definitely was very studious. Like I didn't go out and party. I never got super into that. Like I would go home and just try to be better than everybody else and really just try to set myself apart by like outdoing somebody. And again, I have a couple chefs now that like to joke that like they can't, like I love to not prove people wrong, but like just show them that I know what I'm saying or doing, you know, in a nice way, not in a dickish way. But like I would just double down. I would take what was given to me, you know, environmentally and personally, and just sort of like use that as like inertia to like grow for myself and get better and just be better than everybody else around me as much as I could.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to start talking about the Breslin, where you spent a huge bulk of your time in New York City. Stick with us. We'll be right back here, The Line on Heritage Radio.
Thank you.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe, overlooking Lily Pool Terrace. Chef Rob Newton and chef de cuisine Morgan Jarrett offer warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. Joining me today is Chef Christina Leckie. She runs the kitchen at Reynard's, which is located in the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We're going to get to Reynard's in a little bit, but first I want to talk about where you've spent the bulk of your time in New York City, which is inside of the Ace Hotel, where how many years did you spend at the Ace?
Six.
A good chunk of time.
Yeah, it's a long time.
How did you connect with April Bloomfield in order to be part of that opening team that developed the concepts that still exist in that hotel?
I met April at an event that I was doing at Gilt, actually. And, well, I've known of the Spotted Pig because working uptown, living in Brooklyn or downtown, and always once a month trying to go to the Spotted Pig after work, being a fortunate person to work in a restaurant that's like shut down by 10 p.m. and like getting to go there after and having a meal and not worrying about it closing anytime soon was always pretty exciting. And I really kind of gravitated, like having worked in a restaurant that was very specifically like test heavy, multiple component heavy, and like things you'd work on for weeks and weeks or months and months until you finally are able to put it on the menu. I found her food, like after a day of that kind of stuff, very refreshing and just so like balanced and simple. And it really sort of struck a chord in me. Like I was like, oh, wow, you can just do that. Okay. I hadn't really ever thought about being able to do that, like macerate some cabbage with cheese and lemon and oil, and that's it. And it's a thing, and it's good. And it's funny, when I ate there, I mostly ate vegetables. Like I used to joke when I met her, I was like, I've never had your burger and I've never eaten your nude. I just like didn't like to eat like crazy fatty, like it was just never what I ever wanted to eat. So I was going there and eating a lot of vegetables, hadn't yet developed a palate for chicken liver toast. And I left New York. There was a time when I left New York for about 6 months. My grandfather, who I spoke of earlier, was dying of cancer, and I really wanted to go be with him because he was so special to me. And as you know, working in the restaurant industry, that's sort of impossible. So I moved back to Philadelphia for 6 months to sort of, I thought it would be longer maybe, but it, you know, after he passed away, I realized I my heart was in New York and I needed to head back there. And I was looking for a job, and somebody that I was dating at the time was like, you should really go check out, you know, her restaurants, and like, you know, you love her food, and you know, I bet she would totally love to have you. And I trailed a few times, and I was definitely like very hesitant to take a job that had like French fries on the menu or like a burger on the menu. It was definitely like an ego sort of like, oh God, you know, like, am I like, what does that say about my career? If I'm working in a place that's serving that kind of food, does that mean I'm like not a great, I'm not ever going to be a great chef? It really like, you know, you get so sort of brainwashed when you're cooking very specifically for so long. You know, but she hired, you know, I took a leap of faith and she hired me. And I think at the time I was like the only person she had really ever hired who had prior experience. I feel like she brought up and taught so many of the great people that she's worked with. I felt like I was like had a step up on a lot of people because I had my own background and experience in cooking, and I was able to offer that place a lot very quickly. And it felt obviously immediately rewarding for me.
I'm curious about her intensity level and how that impacted your intensity level. You mentioned burgers and fries, but her pursuit of perfection for any food item, French fries, totally. For example, is... It's really like at a level that most people can't understand unless sure. they've heard of what the process is to even make those French totally. Fries. So she has been known to send plates back multiple times to cooks. Ticket times be damned. The table will get the perfect food regardless of if it matches up with the other three entrees, right?
Yeah.
She's made the decision that nothing leaves the kitchen unless it's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
After you became the leader of her kitchen... You are there to then execute that totally. Vision in your own style. How did that intensity, did you feel like you already had that intensity? Did you have to up your game to match it? Like,
no,
how did that work out?
I feel like when I was running her kitchen, I'd seen other chefs run her kitchen, and I just always knew exactly what she wanted, and I understood how to get the results of those things. And I never was scared when she came in. I wanted her to come in and see that it was like running really well and she could be kind of at ease. I sort of like gunned for it in a lot of ways. And yeah, I think I learned a lot about, I'm sure I upped my intensity level in a way that I'm intense about food now, but not as intense about certain other things. For sure. But yeah, I just think, her and I just kind of hit it off, and I just was really able to like understand what she was going for and what she was looking for, and able to execute it at a really, I think, high and consistent level.
Do you still consider her a mentor since you've left the restaurant? You spent so much time with her personally, even just traveling around.
Totally.
She did a lot of events overseas, and you would often accompany her on those events,
right?
I
was like doing a lot of fun offsite and crazy offsite events. I think she really relied on me in a lot of ways, and I definitely would still call her, of course, a mentor. I mean, she helped expose me to so many amazing experiences and allowed me to blossom on my own creatively and have a lot of say in the day-to-day operations of what the food could be. And I feel like, I got really lucky in that regard. Like, it wasn't just about what she wanted. We were able to sort of have a cohesive, view and say about the food. And I really appreciated her trust in me in that regard.
She definitely did trust you a lot, and you were able to put a lot of great things on the menu. There was a period where the menu was a lot your items.
Totally.
And April, she became very famous while you were working there.
Yeah.
She was well known, but her fame sort of skyrocketed about a year or two into the Breslin. I want to hear your perspective on what it is like to be there executing someone else's vision when they may be not only opening other restaurants, but doing book tours, doing television appearances. Did it ever wear on you? Is there kind of like this weird give and take tug where you're like, I'm here, I'm doing the work, it's under April's name? Did that ever grate on you?
I think eventually towards, I think, the end of my time and after I started, like after I left the day-to-day operations at the Ace, I think I started to be like, okay, whoa, like what am I doing? What am I going to be like trying to like, do my potentially my own thing but I feel like at the time, like I was a pretty loyal like worker. Like I wouldn't have been there if I was feeling bitter or unhappy, like the job is too hard to be in that environment and not be happy in some way. And I felt like I was getting a lot out of it, and I felt rewarded in other ways. And I had built a lot of really strong friendships, and I felt like for me, it was really rewarding being a mentor for so many people in that company that, to be fair, she didn't have time to do that for people, and they were really there for the place and certainly for her name, but, they were staying and and learning from me. And, you know, I feel really proud about the amount of people I've gotten to like catapult into doing other things or gotten them great jobs elsewhere, you know, and that's the stuff that sort of gets, you know, that really sort of kept me going and kept me really motivated.
I want to ask about Ken. You had left the restaurant group when revelations came out about Ken Friedman's actions towards mostly female employees, but also some women that were outside of the company. And a lot of things that happened at the Spotted Pig. Obviously, you can say whatever you want about the topic, but I want to ask a specific question, which you can answer or not, which is, after the allegations came out about Ken, people addressed a lot of hatred and animosity towards April. You're very close to April. I'm curious, just how do you perceive the entire situation, both with Ken and also how April was addressed and treated after the article came out in the New York Times?
Sure. I mean, I'd left the company before all that stuff sort of came to fruition. Mm-hmm. I'd been gone for almost a year at that point, and maybe a full year at the point of the article. I can't quite remember the exact timeline, but, you know, I think, you know, obviously this is a hard topic for me, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's difficult for me to be on radio particularly eloquent about it. And, you know, I think that April is experiencing backlash because I think people see her as a leader and as a female, and I think there is just a general expectation of her doing a bit more and speaking up for her employees a bit more. And I think in her silence, I think that has rubbed some people the wrong way. And I think when you get to a certain point in your career, you have a lot of responsibility and expectation about how you're perceived and how you're supposed to act. And I think for her, she's figuring out how to get herself out there and probably at some point will make a statement and sort of tell her side of everything. But I think it's obviously been a really tough time for that company and for her and all the hard work she'd put into it to sort of see it be exposed in this kind of way, I'm sure is really shocking. And I can't imagine, to be honest, I can't put myself in her shoes and think about how that feels. So, you know, like I said, I think that's sort of why people have come out in that kind of way against her, just because I think she hasn't really said much about it. And I think that's troubling for a lot of people.
I want to talk now about Renard's, where you've been spending the last year. You went from working at perhaps the busiest, most popular hotel in Manhattan to the busiest, most popular hotel in Brooklyn. But they're totally different, right?
Yeah.
I would love for you to talk a little bit about the differences for people that have never been to either one. I'm not sure how that's possible. There seems to be 2,000 people there.
They're definitely totally different.
Every single night. But first, talk a little bit about the difference. Like, what do you do at Reynard's cooking-wise? And then also talk a little bit about how it's part of the Andrew Tarlow organization.
Sure. I feel like, first off, I never thought I'd work in a hotel in general. And then to have worked at two back-to-back hotels was sort of a little shocking for me. And sometimes when I think about where my career has gone, but I think I'm at Renard because I value and respect sort of the vision of what Andrew Tarlow has done and who he is as a restaurateur and an entrepreneur in a way. I just think I can relate to his values and feelings in a lot of real ways that I feel. And I guess I don't look at Renard as a restaurant in a hotel. I just look at it, feel like it's more of a restaurant. I mean, the difference is there's not room service 24 hours. There's no lobby, like giant lobby full of like serving an additional lobby menu. You know, the rooftop bar has a really small limited menu because of we can't really do a lot of cooking up there. You know, it just feels like a slower sort of culturally, like a slower sort of more meaningful environment just because it's less chaotic in a lot of ways. And I think having gone from running such a large operation, that's, you know, I mean, Renard, like the Breslin, is breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But again, there's no 24-hour room service. There's no lobby. There's no like crazy lobby. There's no like, you know, I feel like there's, it's still a lot going on at Renard. I don't want to downplay and make it seem like it's not, can't be crazy. We do a ton of events and I'm staffing, you know, a large all-day food program. I don't know. I think I'm losing track. We get back.
I want to know a little bit about, like, what does it feel like to work in an Andrew Tarlow organization?
Yeah.
Like, has it afforded you any freedoms or any constraints, perhaps?
No. I mean, I feel like Andrew definitely trusts me, and I feel like I definitely can't work for anybody who wouldn't trust me or doesn't trust me. So I do feel like I creatively have full control and full freedom. You know, that being said, I understand what the place is, where the place is. I understand his ethos of, you know, as where we, how we source and where we source. And it's sort of, those were always my values too. And we were sort of sourcing similarly. And so in that regard, it's quite fun. And, you know, for me, it's a really great opportunity to cook on wood fire, cooking on a wood hearth and a wood oven. Has afforded me a really fun, you know, luxury of having that as my day-to-day operation, to be able to like wake, you know, to start of day at like 7 a.m. and like light a fire with the sun blasting in the kitchen is kind of like, it feels really special and refreshing.
The menu at Reynard's feels very much driven by ingredients. And I know that there's this every menu restaurant tries to be ingredient driven, but it really feels like you're picking things that you like and then cooking them the way you want to cook them and not overstuffing the plate.
Yeah.
It feels like you're choosing certain things and you're highlighting them and you're really rolling with that specific product. So I would love for you to talk about how you make those decisions. I know that the Tarlow organization has great farm and direct purveyor ties,
sure.
But like, how are you deciding what cut to use? And also, you have that big hearth. How do you make the decision of what you're going to roast and what you're not going to roast? You know, there could be a tendency to just be like, let's throw it all on the fire, but
which we kind of do. But I do think the good thing about wood cooking, and I do think specifically the way we've set up the hearth, is it's not beating you over the head of like char grilled smoky flavors. There's definitely a lot of layering and a lot of subtlety with it. And I think using the wood in a certain way to make, I think that's what I enjoy about it, because I will say probably 80% of the menu is touching wood in some way, but I don't think you're eating that menu like feeling at the end of it like your palate is completely charred or burnt out, you know, like, mm-hmm. And I sort of, that's sort of like, you know, I guess that's kind of the funny, annoying thing about me. You know, it's like, yes, there's broccoli, but then the broccoli's blanched and then hung in the hearth for 30 minutes. And then we pick it back up on the plancha or the grill. And like, you know, so it's like, yeah, it's just broccoli. But, you know, we definitely try, I just can't help but to try to layer, flavors in a really delicate way. It's just sort of what I've been gravitating towards. And you know, and I want people to eat food in general and feel good about themselves when they're leaving and not feel like they've, like, killed themselves or overstuffed or oversatiated themselves. Like, for me, that's how I want to eat. I want to eat leaving feeling, like, energized and like, revitalized and not feel weighed down by a lot of fat or a lot of, you know, unnecessary substances on a plate.
It's interesting that you mentioned the process of the broccoli, because at Renard's, it does seem like whenever I've eaten there, it feels like you're back there tasting a sauce and there's like adjustments being made on the pickup. It seems like it's, I mean this in a positive way, it seems like it's like a work in progress. Like you're tasting and building flavors like as the day goes on. Conversely, Breslin always felt like, and I mean this again in a positive way, it kind of felt like a factory. Like everything was like, you knew that the burger was going to taste exactly the same every single time. So my question about that is New York, with the staffing problems that we have,
sure,
it feels like it would be easier to do it the Breslin way. Like, sure, weigh the burger out to this, cook it for 4 minutes, put it on the bun, send it out, you know, whatever the process, yeah, is. But it feels like at Renard's, it feels like you really need like super duper heady cooks, you know? Yeah. You don't need like soldiers, you need like cooks. So how have you been able to build your team, train your team, when it's really like you're cooking from really, yeah, deep within?
I mean, it's definitely a challenge because it is, yeah, running an all-day operation, like trying to constantly have enough staff. But I feel like the people who I've been able to work with thus far, I think they're really happy being in an environment where the food is being like highly respected and well looked after, and that they're, sorry, I'm drinking sparkling. That they're being held accountable, that somebody's like looking after them and paying attention. I think in a lot of kitchens, like, you know, you can be ignored or not like, or be allowed to serve something mediocre, or that, you know, and I can't let people do that. not on my watch anyway, but you know, and I think people really respond to that, because I do feel like I've found a way to do that in a really positive, rewarding way, and not in like sort of a soul degrading, like beat down kind of way. And I think that's what people are there for. They're there for like to work with really amazing product and to be treated with respect and to be looked after and cared for.
Beyond staffing, which everyone seems to be struggling with the last couple years for sure, I'm curious about what's giving you problems, what's keeping you up at night in your job. Like, is it food costing? Is it sourcing? Like, what's a challenge for you as the executive chef of Renard's that's maybe specific to your gig or not?
I definitely think, I mean, what? There's so many challenges. I feel like there's endless menus sometimes for me to work on. I'm like always kind of behind keeping up with, like, you know, the constant, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner menus. And I think for me, it's what keeps me up is making sure that I'm finding time for the creative balance that I so desperately need and want, because I do feel like if I'm not being creative, then I'm not my happiest self. And I feel like when I feel like I've gotten away from my creative self is when I start to sort of like, not panic, but I get a little nervous, because I don't want to lose that part of myself in a large operation.
There's a misconception that a lot of things that are hearth items cooked over fire are going to be like heavy and more wintry. You know, it's like,
sure,
big chops, roasted vegetables that you then maybe puree, and there's a lot of, yeah, butter. So is there something that it just basically got hot like this week, but it is almost summer.
Yeah.
Moving into the warmer months, is there a dish or something that you're really excited about using, a product that you're gonna put in the hearth, that you're gonna conceptualize a dish that is like a light summer dish that still has, sure, that roasty aspect to it?
I mean, I'm really enjoying like now just we've been using like green chickpeas and like just started getting fava beans, and you know, blistering, being able to char those things whole in the coals and then have these like not touched on the inside but smoky and like lightly charred. And I think that sort of then moving into tomatoes, and I feel like those are the kind of things that right now I'm like really excited about, and then taking those, all those pod shells and making like a really light broth with them and using that on another dish. So I think the thing that I really enjoy about having the hearth is that it is a source of so much flavor layering and product. Like, you can really do things like 100 different ways, and, you know, maybe you're grilling something, or maybe you're throwing things directly in the coals, or, you know, or using like the plancha in some way, or hanging something, or resting stuff over the, for me, it's like, it's an endless journey of having, like 100 different ways to like cook a carrot.
I'm gonna close on this final question, and it's kind of a big one. There's no monetary constraints. do you have a dream of doing your own restaurant one day? And if yes, where do you think it might be, and what do you think it might look like? You can dream as small or as big as you really want, and what does that vision look like?
If I'm dreaming, I'm probably no longer in the United States, and I would love to just be doing something really tiny with like one or two of my closest friends. So at the end of the day, I have somebody to like smile with and like have a drink with, and you know, and the food just really be about, you know, the smallest little things of the day and being able to change things on a whim, because that's all you have to do, or close when you don't want to be open. And, you know, and that's obviously very unrealistic in at least most of this country. And yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of definitely something small and somewhere not anywhere near here.
For now, though, you can find her in Williamsburg at Renard's. What's the address there?
80 Wythe Avenue.
80 Wythe Avenue. They do breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
We do it all.
Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Eli. Thanks for having me.
Join us again next Tuesday and every Tuesday for new episodes of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.